The Leprechaun Lunch with Sean and Sharpley.
Oh, yeah!
On 96.1 WSBT, the sports leader.
What is this?
We're talking Notre Dame football, the NFL, the Cubs, and more.
Oh, yeah, I like this idea.
The Leprechaun Lunch.
Pretty good. Pretty good.
With Sean Stiers.
All you do is drip.
I have to dribble. If I give it to you, you just shoot.
And Evan Sharpley.
You're a chucker. You chuck.
If it's happening in sports.
Fumble!
We're talking about it.
Flag on the play.
Now your hosts. Woo! Sean Stiers and former Irish quarterback. Evan Sharpley.
Welcome to an awesome Friday. Sean and Sharpley and the Leprechaun Lunch 96.1 WSBT, the sports leader. Presented by Bud Light Seltzer, light and refreshing, four fruit flavors, just 100 calories, 2 grams of carbs, less than a gram of sugar. It is Bud Light Seltzer in mango, strawberry, lemon, lime, and black cherry. I'm looking out my window, and I've got sunshine, at least for right now. It's supposed to get up over 70 degrees today. Great way to kick into Memorial Day weekend. What do you think, Evan Sharpley?
Yeah, it was 70 today. I think 75 tomorrow. It's supposed to be up in the 80s next week. Things are looking up.
Kick back with a Bud Light Seltzer on the porch later on.
That's right.
Today. Let me ask you this. It is Memorial Day weekend, Monday being Memorial Day. When did you find out? When did you actually know it was that Memorial Day was coming up? Was it on your radar?
Well,
I guess that's what I'm asking.
Yeah, I'll be honest, it was. And just for the reason being is that a few of my clients between Ascension Day, which was yesterday, especially within the Amish community, and then Memorial Day on Monday, some of them were down. They weren't running production.
Okay.
A couple of the RV companies. Some are still running, but there were a couple that were down, and that was the only reason why I knew. That was it.
Okay. So Monday was the 18th, May 18th, and with it being that early, it wasn't on my radar at all, and we had former Notre Dame, current LSU baseball coach Paul Maneri on earlier this week, and we'll hear, we've got a few of his sound bites that we'll hear, and he coached, of course, Evan at Notre Dame. We'll hear a little bit from Paul Maneri coming up in the show. So I think it was Monday, Darren was teasing the fact that we had Paul coming up on Sports Beat earlier this week, and he said something about, yeah, he would be at the SEC tournament this week, and I went, hold it, what? You know, because again, this is 10 weeks now we've been at home, and I wasn't even thinking about, oh yeah, this would be college baseball's conference tournament week, and what that means is it leads up to Memorial Day weekend, and then Memorial Day is always college baseball's selection show. It's selection show Monday. That's when they have, they announce the field of 64 and all that stuff. That's obviously not going on. So, and then really, it was like the next morning that it hit me in full. I'm like, so hold it. Because, you know, again, he said that. And I'm like, so hold it. Monday is Memorial Day. I didn't even realize.
Time sure goes by fast when you're having so much fun in quarantine.
All these days have just been a blur. You know, one day has not meant much different than the rest. So hope everybody has a safe Memorial Day weekend. And we hope that we get you kicked off on the right foot. We've got a lot coming up, including Paul Maneri. We'll get to that in the second segment. Some thoughts from him with kind of a bit of an unofficial announcement that he dropped on us in the course of the interview. He had some thoughts on new Notre Dame baseball coach Link Jarrett, some other memories. He talked about his legacy. We'll hear all that. And also, just last night, there's a report came out, D1Baseball.com, about a rather radical proposal to move college baseball season more into the summer. The College World Series currently wraps up at the end of June. It always begins Father's Day weekend in early June and wraps up in late June. And the college season currently begins in mid-February. But there is a proposal that's kind of gaining some steam, and a lot of it has to do with the pandemic and finances. Like everything else, it has to do with finances. And so that's gaining steam. It would potentially end the season later in July, or maybe even early August. But Evan, being a former Notre Dame baseball player, we will talk about that and more. We'll also touch on The Last Dance later in this hour, as well as some of Horace Grant's comments on Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen, and more. But first, Evan, the big news this week, Notre Dame announced that the fall semester is going to begin 2 weeks earlier. It'll start August 10th with students on campus. There's going to be no stoppage for fall break in October, with the semester ending before Thanksgiving. And this is something that we touched on a little bit last week, the possibility of this, because Jack Swarbrick was quoted in a SportsIllustrated.com article kind of teasing that this could happen. Then lo and behold, a few days later, it was made official by Notre Dame. So just your initial thoughts on the moving of the calendar and the fall semester for Notre Dame.
Well, I mean, if you're a college football fan, which I assume a lot of people listening to the show probably are, you know, that bodes well for football here this fall. You know, that was one of the hurdles as part of the conversation that, you know, most people were having was, you know, it's unlikely that college football would start if universities were not allowing or not having students back on campus in person, right, for classes. If they were only doing virtual classes, you probably weren't going to see a football team at a given program or university suit up and play. So for Notre Dame football fans, you know, I think there's a glimmer of hope. Now, we're still a long way away. Really, we aren't. It is Memorial Day, so we are creeping closer. But you know, there's going to have to be, you know, a number of decisions being made. So this was one of those decisions right now. Along that timeline too, then, is players and certain students being allowed back on campus as early as the first week of June. That was another thing that we weren't really sure of. But the big one certainly being that students will be back on campus in South Bend at the University of Notre Dame this fall. With a little bit of a different schedule, and I think, you know, part of it is trying to not have students go home, come back, and then eliminate best they can either a resurgence in, you know, COVID-19 or, right, just the seasonal flu by not going back and forth, and then also starting earlier and finishing earlier and getting students out of there. So certainly a positive thing if you're a college football fan, because now, you know, more signs are pointing to a football season really starting on schedule. Now, we don't know what that is going to look like, fans in the stands and the environment and social distancing, but it does look like that's, you know, that's the trend right now, with both having in-person classes and now having athletes allowed to be back on campus for voluntary workouts.
Yeah, exactly. And the day after Notre Dame made this announcement that students will be back on campus August 10th and go through the fall semester, Father John Jenkins, Notre Dame president Father John Jenkins, was on NBC's Today Show. And one of the hosts, Savannah Guthrie, asked an important question, I guess, on behalf of sports and football fans.
Coming for Notre Dame. What about football? You've got fans across the country. Is there a chance that football could come back?
Well, you know, that our primary focus has been our educational mission, so that's what we've thought about to this point. But obviously, we're going to talk about athletics. It's not just our decision; it's a decision of all institutions in Division I across the nation. And so, we're going to talk to them, and we'll see what is safe and what is possible. I hope we'll have sports. I hope we'll have football. We'll just have to see.
So non-committal on that, Father John Jenkins on the Today Show. But at the same time, Evan, if college football is coming back, this is the first step that had to happen. There had to be students back on campus, and this announcement is the first step kind of towards that ends.
Yeah, I think that was the general sentiment, is once a decision was made on that, on having in-person classes, then, you know, you start to look at what models are like to actually play games. Now, what's going to be interesting is to, you know, to keep an eye on states that are still, you know, honoring the stay-at-home orders. You know, Michigan, California being another one where you have some major universities who are supposed to abide by the guidelines set out by governors and local leadership. and what that's going to look like. Because with some states opening up, and now here in Indiana, you know, we're in phase three of reopening the economy, and what that looks like, and trying to get back on track with businesses opening, but there are still a number of states that aren't doing that. So, and I know we went into a little bit of detail over the last couple of weeks on how segmented it could be along state lines, political lines, specific conferences. So, yes, you're right. The first hurdle, if you want to call it a hurdle, or I guess the first box that you have to check, at least in our world of a Notre Dame football fan, has been checked in that in-person classes will be occurring this fall. But like I said, there's still a lot of decisions that have to be made.
Absolutely.
On what exactly a college football season is going to look like here if it is to start in September.
What do you think about the possibility of what Darren and I were talking about this yesterday? If Notre Dame has limited fans in the stands, because Ohio State started talking about it a couple of days ago, their capacity is over 100,000, and they talked about being able to space people out. What do you think it looks like at Notre Dame Stadium? I mean, who do you think is in there, and what that looks like if you're socially distancing for at least the first part of the schedule?
Well, it would be very unique, right? I mean, you look at student sections across the country, you know, they're piled in on top of each other. They've usually had a few libations. I'm curious what a tailgating experience is going to look
right.
like. You know, our students, because Jack Swarbrick has been very outspoken in saying, you know, he has a tough time of seeing a college football game being played without the atmosphere of having students watching the games. I mean, do you file the students out, you know, in orderly fashion from their dorms? And what's the process of being let into the game? You know, are masks going to be mandatory? Are there temperature checks as you walk in? I don't know. I mean, that's the thing, I think, from his seat, and also for you know Father John, I mean, that's the million-dollar question: is how do you do it in a manner that doesn't upset people and keeps people safe, but still, it's still, you're creating somewhat of an environment to watch a venue and watch a game. So I don't know what it's going to be. I would assume that the students will be made priority number one. And then, I don't know, is it going to be an all-out bidding war and ticket gouging? I don't know. I mean, if it's limited, I mean, Ohio State was saying anywhere maybe between 20,000 to 50,000 fans. So that's well under half of their capacity. Notre Dame, it could be less than that. I don't know what that exactly looks like, and I don't envy whoever has to make that decision and coordinate that on game day, because a game day experience anywhere, it's nuts. I mean, you walk through tailgating experience, you walk through parking cars, people walking in. I mean, I don't know how you distance. How do you?
Yeah. Well,
there's no way you could.
The one thing about that, though, let's say you're cutting, because Notre Dame's capacity is what, around 77,000, something like that. So if you're going to say you're going to have a third of that there, somewhere around 25,000 as opposed to 77,000, that sort of naturally, for the tailgating experience, that naturally cuts down some of that. And you might have to tell people you're not allowed to tailgate,
well,
you know, unless you have a ticket.
you'd have to do that, because
right. But then you
could
space things out a lot more in the in the parking lots and stuff like that, I guess. But still, how you sort of regulate how people are going to gather once they park, you know, there's just so much that goes with it.
It's going to be tough. It's going to be tough.
We got a Twitter question from Dave, and he's asking about basketball. He's asking about whether there might not be students for Notre Dame men's basketball game even into January. And I mean, I think that you know, there's probably some conversation going on there to some extent, but I think the biggest issue that they're still trying to figure out is football. Since, you know, let's be honest, football is the cash cow for, you know, 90% of the schools in the country, even more so than college basketball. And I mean, I do think that has to be figured out. And I think that there is a question right now about the college basketball season in general, men's and women's, what might happen. And I'm not trying to kind of, you know, strike an alarmist kind of thing, but I think the biggest thing is going to be football, figuring out that, and also if they are able to get all the way through a college basketball or a college football season, because testing is going to be the big thing. And then one of the bigger questions is, what happens if someone tests positive? How do you handle that? How do you handle it if it's someone on the team? How do you handle it if it's a head coach? Because, you know, you can talk about the age demographics and who's affected more than others. And even though younger people are not affected as much, younger people with pre-existing conditions can be more affected, and they can also still be carriers. And your coaching staffs tend to be from the demographic that is more affected. So, I mean, there's a lot that has to be figured out in terms of what does happen if and when someone does test positive over the course of a college football season.
Yeah, and it's, I think, you know, in listening to some of the talking heads and those in positions of power, coaches as well, in the college landscape, it's once there is a positive test, because I think it's safe to assume there's probably going to be one, Sean. I mean, I can't just based on the math, I've got to think at some point or the in another, it's going to happen. But it's not necessarily to freak out. To be cautious and to be safe. That's smart, absolutely. But I think it would be very devastating if then a positive test would result in the season being over. And that's not me being selfish and being callous towards athletes' health, because it could blow up on a team, right? If one tests positive, you know, you could easily then have an entire team. So there's still a lot of unknown, but the testing part will be key. You know, trying to limit it as best you can. You know, how many people you're around, which again, if you're doing in-person classes in the fall and you've got college-age students, that's going to be hard in itself. So I'm trying to think as positive as possible, Sean.
Oh, I am too.
But, you know, there's still a number of scenarios that, and I'm sure in all of these meetings, that there are a lot of worst case scenarios thrown out there and models on how do we react and what do we do so that they're prepared in the case that something does go bad.
But Evan, as positive as we want to be, here are a couple of facts. It was 3 weeks ago today that Governor Holcomb, but, you know, made the announcement that we were, you know, that they, the reopening plan for the state. St. Joe County had 645 positive tests 3 weeks ago today. Today, the number is 1,082. Indiana had 19,295 reported cases 3 weeks ago today. Today, the number is 30,409. So they're the numbers are still going up. So as positive as we want to be, you know, as you said, the numbers say that somebody's going to test positive at some point. It's a matter of how do you work around it and keep it from, especially on a college campus where you have people on a day-to-day basis in much tighter quarters, how do you keep it from rapidly spreading around a campus situation, which is why everyone went home to begin with. So, all right, let's try to change the tone a little bit here. I've got some props for the season. We're going to try to get through a bunch of them quickly because we have still a lot of stuff that we want to get to after this in the course of this show. Some Vegas betting lines for Notre Dame for the upcoming season. There are five games that Vegas has betting lines for right now. Notre Dame is a 17.5-point favorite against Arkansas. Which way would you go on that, Evan? Do you like them to cover that against the Hawks?
I like them to cover that. I think they'll win by more than 17.5.
Yeah, I typically don't like double-digit spreads, but of course it's a home game. Arkansas was 2-10 last year. They do have a new coach this year. How quickly he's able to change things, who knows, even though, you know, the same boat for Louisville last year, and they were able to turn things around. So that's kind of a wait and see. Another double-digit favorite, the season opener, Notre Dame is minus 16.5 against Navy. Which way would you go on that one?
Go Irish. I'll take the over.
Yeah, Notre Dame won by 40 the last time they opened the season against Navy. So I would take them as well on that one as well. Notre Dame, a 10-point favorite against Stanford. Mm. Do you like them to cover that one?
I like them to cover that one, too.
I do, too, especially after KJ Costello, the quarterback, transferred in the offseason. He entered the transfer portal, so I like him in that one. Notre Dame is +2.5, an underdog against Wisconsin. How about that one?
Well, just going into it, you know, I've got Notre Dame at 10-2, and I think that potentially that's one of their losses, so I'm okay with that.
I like Notre Dame against Wisconsin because they are, I'm not saying they're completely one-dimensional, but they are very reliant on the run game. They rushed for over 200 yards in 8 of their 14 games last season, but look at A.J. Dillon. He averaged like 140 yards a game last year, the Boston College running back. Notre Dame held him to under 60 yards. So I like Notre Dame to win this one outright. And the final line that we have, the Fighting Irish, a 7.5-point underdog against Clemson. And I have an idea of which way you're going here.
Yeah, I'm going to go with Clemson here.
I like Notre Dame to cover that, though. Clemson might win, but I do like Notre Dame to cover that 7.5 in a home game for the Irish. The NCAA is going to allow players to wear the number 0 for the first time this year. Do you like that idea?
I don't know. Is there a reason why no one was allowed to wear it previously?
I wonder that as well. I was, when I heard this announcement, it's like, oh yeah, nobody has been able to wear 0, even though double 0, as an example, has been allowed in college basketball. So
I guess, I mean, I assume because it's a single digit, it's still going to be quarterbacks, receivers, running backs. Defensive back. Well, do you think like an offensive lineman's going to come out wearing 0?
I don't think an offensive lineman will, but if
maybe a defensive end.
If Lewis Nix was here, Lewis Nix, right, I bet would be wearing the number
probably
0. I don't know about you. So my dark horse maybe is Kurt Heinisch, the guy who's playing Lewis Nix's position.
Okay.
He's got his eye black and the stuff all over his face, and he's wearing number 0 as well.
Don't know. Since it's brand new, I like your take. Since it's brand new, man, if I'm a quarterback, I might go after it because no one's ever done it before.
Why not?
Yeah.
I mean, Denard Robinson wore, what was that, 98 a few years
ago? Yeah,
back.
98.
That was in honor of, you know.
Tom Harmon, yeah.
Right, right. But still, I mean, it was unique. So, I don't. I think still love. Go ahead.
I know you love Friday Night Lights.
Right.
But I still dig quarterbacks, especially like in high school too, that wear like number 20 or like,
right,
22.
21, 22, yeah, exactly. Or even 23, and we'll talk about Michael Jordan later on. All right, Alabama and LSU, speaking of quarterbacks, they both have new quarterbacks this season. Will Ian Book throw more touchdowns than either of them, neither of them, or both of them this season?
Sean, both of them.
Ooh.
Both.
Coming on
so
strong.
I went back through the archives.
Okay.
And outside of Tua and Burrow, and even if you look at Burrow the previous year, he threw 16 TDs. You know, the 60 was unbelievable, record-setting. Tua was over 30, over 40, you know, in back-to-back years.
Yeah.
But even with Jalen Hurts, you know, I think the most he threw in a season was 21. It's more typical of Alabama and LSU, their quarterbacks to be in that range of 15 to 25.
Right.
And I think Book's going to go over 30 again. I do. So I'm going to take Ian Book on this. Now, the reason why is you have two quarterbacks and one, you know, at Alabama who has played a little bit, but still, it's two really, you know, unproven entities. It's not Tua and it's not Burrow. So I'm just going based off of the historical data really over the past 5 or 6 years,
yeah,
where it's more of an anomaly for a quarterback to throw over 30. And I guess longer than that, probably the last 8 years. It's more of an anomaly for a quarterback from LSU or Alabama to consistently throw 30 or 40 touchdown passes. So I'm going to take Book on this one.
Okay. I like your line of thinking there. I am more confident that Book will have more than the Alabama quarterback. It should be Mac Jones. He was Tua's backup last year, got to play and all that. But I definitely agree with what you're saying there, because I think that Alabama without Tua becomes less the dynamic downfield offense and that kind of stuff. And they go back to their staple where maybe they're more smash mouth after, you know, not being in that playing for championships the last couple of years. I don't think that LSU's potential starter, Miles Brennan, throws 60 like Joe Burrow. I don't even think that he throws over 40. But I like Book definitely to throw more than Alabama's quarterback. I don't know what'll happen at LSU. When you look at the fact that Joe Burrow could go from 16 to 60 in 1 year, who knows, you know, what could happen
right
down there. So how many touchdowns do you see Book throwing this season?
I've got 30 plus. Darren posted a Twitter poll question.
Yep.
And I voted for the 30 to 34. You know, I'm pretty comfortable right now sitting and saying, you know, based on what he's done, having a veteran offensive line too, I think that that's very, very likely. But if he gets hot, who knows? You know, it could be in that 35 to 40 range too, where if he has a couple of games of, you know, four or five touchdown passes, he's shown that he can do that. But I'm going to stick with that 30 to 34. I think that that's very, very doable.
I'm just a little bit higher than you. I've got him at 35. And, of course, he threw 34 last year. 15 of them were against the three group of five teams, and they have one less group of five team this year. So he was 15 touchdowns, no interceptions against those three teams, and the rest of his touchdown production, 19 touchdowns, came against the other 10 teams on the schedule. So I'm at 35. Vince D'Addario thinks he's going to be over 40 even. I don't know about that. I guess we'll see. I don't know exactly where the carries and stuff are going to go, but I think the run game is going to look different this year, and maybe that affects his touchdown total as well. Who would be your Heisman Trophy favorite, Evan Sharpley, and who would be your Heisman Trophy dark horse?
Trevor Lawrence or Justin Fields. I mean, they're going to
slam dunk.
I think those two are slam dunks. I mean, if you're looking at a dark horse, I put down Ian Book. You know, if he throws over 40 touchdown passes, I think he could potentially be in the conversation. And, you know, if Notre Dame beats Clemson and beats Wisconsin, or plays Clemson tough and Book plays a good game, and maybe they're 11-1 and in conversation for a college football playoff spot, you could see him there. And then another guy too, you know, you can't count out right now any quarterback that plays for Oklahoma. So I put down Spencer Rattler. You know, it's he's got some shoes to fill, but if you look at what that position has done, you know, for the Sooners over the last few years, guys being in a position to win Heisman trophies and put up, you know, some crazy stats, he's got all the physical tools to make it happen.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, Trevor Lawrence, he's definitely going to be in the conversation all year. Clemson's schedule is fairly soft, so my thinking is that works against him. Ohio State's Justin Fields, like if you look at Vegas, Lawrence is the favorite going into the season. Fields is right behind him. Fields had 41 touchdowns last year. I think the fact that Ohio State is playing Oregon, Michigan, Penn State, Iowa, those kind of schools, compared to Notre Dame, should be Clemson's toughest opponent. And so I think that maybe that gets held against Trevor Lawrence, especially if there are any kind of bumps in the road for him over the course of it. I think that the stronger schedule that Fields and Ohio State play make him my favorite. My dark horse, because of what we were just talking about, the fact that I think Alabama is a little bit more of a ground team this year, is Najee Harris, the Alabama running back who ran for over 1,200 yards last year. So that would be my dark horse Heisman guy. Last question, and you kind of answered this. Book has plus 2,200 odds to win the Heisman. On a scale of 1 to 10, what chances do you give him to be a Heisman finalist?
A Heisman finalist?
Yeah. Which means final?
Five.
Yeah, okay.
Five.
50-50?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So that I'm not sitting on the fence, I'll say four.
Okay. All right, so a little bit under 50-50. Yeah, and I'm right around a 3.5, probably. I just think he is going to have a monster kind of year. The fact that he is the Notre Dame quarterback does help them, but he also can't afford to have any bumps in the road. If they would lose to Clemson, he has to have one of those kind of immaculate games and lose a great game that is not his fault kind of thing. Obviously, if he beats Clemson, it's over, so that helps him out greatly. That could really vault him into the conversation if they would pick up a win over Clemson in November that late in the season. All right, we will save some of the rest of the stuff. We got through most of them. We'll save some of the others for next week's show as we continue to kind of look and predict and see what might happen over the course of Notre Dame's 2020 college football season that, of course, we all hope does come to fruition. We will take a timeout right now. When we come back, you'll hear from former Notre Dame baseball coach Paul Maneri, the Hall of Famer who's now at LSU. He joined us on Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat earlier this week. We'll get some of Evan's thoughts on that. Maneri coached Evan Sharpley at Notre Dame. And also a proposal to shift the college baseball season more into the summer that is really gaining some traction here with the current situation with schools facing tough financial decisions. Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat. Leprechaun Lunch with Sean and Sharpley continues. We're presented by Bud Light Seltzer. 100 calories, 2 grams of carbs, less than a gram of sugar. It is Bud Light Seltzer, 96.1 WSBT, the sports leader. Leprechaun Lunch with Sean and Sharpley, 96.1 WSBT, the sports leader. Bud Light Seltzer is our presenting sponsor. Light and refreshing, 4 fruit flavors, mango, strawberry, lemon, lime, black cherry. It is Bud Light Seltzer. Along with former Notre Dame quarterback and baseball player Evan Sharpley, Sean Stiers on a beautiful Friday afternoon in Michiana. Evan, your former Notre Dame baseball coach, Paul Maneri, who's been at LSU amazingly for 14 years now, joined us on Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat. Darren Pritchett asked me this, so I'll ask you, what do you think is the number one thing that's made Maneri so successful as a college baseball coach?
Well, I think he always, you know, he knows the type of team he wants, does a good job of recruiting that way and building teams around it. There's a method, you know, there's a structure he has. He has, I think, what he wants that makeup to be. It's usually centered around, you know, timely hitting, good pitching and defense. And here specifically at Notre Dame, I mean, there was a certain type of player that he recruited. That was very evident when you looked at rosters. But, I think he does a good job of getting the best out of his guys as a coach, but also he brings in some really good assistants, who have gone on to be head coaches at other places as well. But he lets those guys do their thing, develop players and build players. So I think from top to bottom, he's a manager in the sense that he lets his assistants help coach, but he knows the type of team he wants and then goes after it.
Yeah, Brian O'Connor, of course, probably his most successful guy, the coach at Virginia, won a national championship a few years ago. Cliff Godwin, who was part of the staff when you were here, he's the head coach at East Carolina. Terry Rooney, who was the pitching coach, he's been a head coach. He's an assistant at Houston now, and even players like Eddie Smith, your old buddy Eddie Smith, who's part of Maneri's staff now down there at LSU.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Darren asked Maneri during our interview if he knew Notre Dame head coach Link Jarrett before Jarrett got the job here at Notre Dame last summer, and we got an interesting answer. He hit a couple of different things, so have a listen to what Maneri had to say about that.
Oh, you know, I did not know Link at all before he became the coach at Notre Dame. I can tell you that shortly after he was named, I sent him a pretty lengthy text message, and wishing him well. And he immediately called me, and we had a really nice conversation. And then we've had several conversations since then. I think they've really picked a great one there. I think Link's a winner, and he's obviously, created a culture there now where they expect to win, which is, the way it should be at Notre Dame. You know, my son Nicholas is a Notre Dame graduate, and he's back up there in South Bend, and he's actually the academic advisor for the baseball team. So you can't get rid of the Maneris totally when it comes to Notre Dame baseball, okay?
Why would you want to? Come on.
But, Notre Dame baseball will always occupy a very big part of my heart. the 12 years I spent there. I loved every second of it. Those players that I had through those 12 years still are, I'm very close with many of them. I hear from them all the time. And, you know, I would want nothing but success for Notre Dame baseball. And it was hurting a lot of us that had put so much into the program when they had some pretty lean years there, you know, over the last several years, and it bothered us all. So I'm hoping that Link can get them back into national prominence, and certainly he was off to a great start. That sweep at North Carolina was awesome. You know, they were off to a great start. It would have been exciting to see them continue and hopefully get into the NCAA tournament again. Now, you know, next year they're coming down to LSU and we have to play them. So I have to root against them for one game. They're going to be part of the opening weekend series is our Military Appreciation Weekend, which I have every other year.
Awesome.
So Air Force, Army, LSU and Notre Dame will be the four schools. So we only have to play them one time. So I'll have to put my love of Notre Dame on the shelf just for one game next year.
So that was the news that Maneri broke in the course of that interview, because, of course, Notre Dame has not released next year's schedule yet. That typically happens sometime over the course of the summer and even early in the fall semester. So this will be the third time that Notre Dame will make the trip to Baton Rouge since Maneri has been down there. And as Paul Maneri said, Army and Air Force will be there as well. So Notre Dame will play LSU just once. Just thoughts on that, Evan, and also kind of a cool story about how Paul Maneri and Link Jarrett connected there early on.
Yeah, first off, congrats to Paul for figuring out some technology and sending text messages. That's pretty good. But yeah, how neat then, though, you know, that Coach Jarrett then, you know, called him up, you know, right away, and they had a conversation, and certainly I'm sure he tried to pick his brain on, you know, his time at Notre Dame and having subsequent conversations since then. You know, he's got to be pretty cool. A little surprised, certainly, you know, that Paul maybe didn't know who he was prior to. But you know, I don't know how that looks within the coaching world. But, you know, certainly there's probably a bond now. But, yeah, you know, that's pretty cool and speaks to, you know, Paul. You know, once he saw that he got the job, he certainly didn't have to reach out to him, but did. And then, you know, even to hear that, you know, both him and then likely a number of assistants that were with him at Notre Dame, you know, have kind of taken it to heart that the program has struggled for the last 10 years, really, after where they had gotten it. So
yeah.
I think we're all hopeful, you know, of what Coach Jarrett brings to the table and kind of getting the culture turned around. And they were off to a great start. And hopefully that, you know, that continues as we move into the future here and next spring, you know, possibly kicking it off with a nice series there against LSU and hitting the ground running.
Evan, I wanted to get into this story that came out yesterday at D1Baseball.com. It is a potential shift of the college baseball season from its current model that begins in February and runs through late June. The College World Series wraps up in late June, and the story begins: a College World Series in mid-July, an NCAA tournament beginning in early July, a college baseball season beginning the third weekend of March. Those are all things that will happen beginning with the 2022 season if a set of recommendations assembled by a five-coach panel of Power Five coaches gets approval from other Division I coaches and passes at the highest level of the NCAA in the coming months. The panel who put together the proposed new baseball model includes Michigan head coach Eric Bakich, who, of course, led Michigan to the College World Series a couple of years ago, a host of other Power Five head coaches, including former Notre Dame assistant Brian O'Connor, who is now at Virginia, Ole Miss head coach Mike Bianco, Cal Poly's Larry Lee, East Carolina's Cliff Godwin, another former Notre Dame assistant who is coaching at his alma mater, Oklahoma State's Josh Holliday, and others. And here's a quote from Bakich before I kind of let you get into this, because there's a lot to it, and we're not going to be able to get as deep as I'd like, but Here's the quote. This isn't the competitive equity proposal we've seen in previous years, and the coaches who've been working on this proposal do not need changes in order to have successful programs. This is about the sustainability and growth of college baseball for the 2022 season and beyond. Universities and athletic departments across the country are facing a financial crisis, and our sport operates at a significant financial net loss amongst teams. That's not a good combination, end quote. And again, that's from the Michigan head coach, Eric Bakich. And just to touch on the financial, this article put together, they got economic feedback from this group. In basically looking at the last 4 years, the average savings, when you look at the fact, if you shift the schedule the way they're talking about, like most schools that aren't in the SEC and the Sun Belt type teams in the ACC have to travel, because like Notre Dame and Michigan, for example, you're talking about starting seasons in February, and it's completely not feasible to play baseball at home. Notre Dame last year played its first 18 games on the road, and if we look at LSU, they played 17 of their first 21 games at home, with three of the road games being a premier series at Texas. But so if you shifted the schedule, you don't have to travel as much. The average savings is about $144,000 a year, just what you're saving in lack of travel. So that is a big piece to it. And so again, Evan, there's a lot here, but your thoughts on this whole thing?
I don't know. Can they start it next year? I mean, I think it's a great idea. What it may do, though, it's going to make it, I'm speaking from my personal experience, it would make it harder for a baseball football guy most likely to play two sports. But that's just me being selfish. I think if you're playing baseball only, I think this is, for lack of a better term, I think this is a home run. You have the savings side of things, and we just saw that, due to COVID, Bowling Green University, their baseball team is going to fold.
And most
programs are operating at a deficit. So if you don't have the cash cow that's football, with all that is uncertain right now, it doesn't make sense for some of these programs to work. So if you shift the schedule and you're able to save that much money, you maybe are able to create a brand and create a following throughout the summer months where kids aren't in school, families are looking for things to do. It's almost like a minor league atmosphere where you're going to a college baseball game now, and maybe you're filling the stands, because if your first 18 games are away from where you are, and I've played in those games, even when you come back and it's still in February when your first home game, it's snowing against Central Michigan, and,
right.
and you're the only people in the stands are your family. Could you start to create an atmosphere where revenue is actually generated for the sport if you're saving money on travel, and then you're starting to build a following through those summer months in late May, June and July? I think it'd be a really fun thing for college programs. Outside of the money savings, it does help northern schools because you're playing in warmer months now. Now, some questions with it. Where does then the Major League Baseball draft? Is that changed when that is?
Exactly.
How does it affect college summer leagues? Right. How does it affect college summer leagues?
Which is a big one. I mean, it's a big one for the college summer leagues. But if you're playing college baseball in the summer instead, I think that there's not necessarily an impact on college baseball itself.
Correct. Yeah. And if you ask college coaches, they'd prefer to have their guys in the summer anyways.
But now part of that, though, is like guys who are reserves during a college baseball season can go in a summer and get, 50, 60 at-bats and get some experience that they're not getting if they're a reserve, on the regular team.
And you know what? Based on the proposed schedule, too, I mean, even if it's if shifted out a little bit and you're starting to see some of the postseason play in June and July, not every team is going to make it that far. So you'd start to have college leagues formulating, whether it's the Northwoods League or the Cape Cod League, which is a little more of an elite league. There'd have to be a couple of the dates on the calendar would have to shift on when the draft would be or when those leagues would be, because if you're pushing it until June or July, the season being over, you know, likely a guy who's drafted as either a junior or a senior or a junior college player, they're going to miss the majority of the minor league season anyways.
Right.
So I think, you know, what's great is you have a lot of bright minds, successful coaches in college right now working through those things. So I've got to believe that if this proposal goes through, you know, they'll be able to work with and set up ways where these questions that we have, you know, they come up with something creative that's going to work for the development of everybody. I know, you know, James Andrews, who's an arm specialist, does a lot of Tommy John type surgeries. He was on this panel as well. I'm sure that for him, you know, what this does is, you know, it eliminates some colder weather months, but also will help with, you know, the training phase and onboarding guys so you see fewer arm injuries.
Well, and here's I guess, my question, because we talk about the travel for the northern teams, and you know, I haven't sat down and looked at the numbers, but I think the majority of college baseball teams actually are northern teams. And so what happens when the season starts in February, if you push it back a month and you're starting in mid-March instead, which is about the time that Notre Dame gets to start playing some of those, you know, even cold weather games around here. But this is going to... The ripple effect on this is the SEC and the Sun Belt schools, who are used to hosting all these northern teams in February and early March, instead of getting to host all those games. And I talked about LSU, 17 of their first 21 games at home last year. Now they've got to maybe start going on the road a bit more in February. So I guess. And I'm not just making this an LSU thing, but really across the SEC and Florida State, Miami, whatever it happens to be, are those schools who are also able to generate good revenue out of college baseball as a result of getting to host these teams, are they going to be willing to give that revenue up? Because ultimately, this is going to come to a vote. Are they going to be willing to put the greater good of college baseball ahead of their own financial needs to get this to go through?
I mean, for this to work, you know, everyone's going to have to be on the same page.
Right.
I'm glad that there's good representation from schools, both in, you know, the northern states and in the southern states, because you get pretty good perspective. So I got to believe they'll put together a proposal that, you know, it benefits college baseball and everyone, you know, decides to sign off. But I think the names on that panel, if they're the ones pushing this, I'm just gonna go on the assumption that it's likely to get pushed through.
Yeah, and again, there's good representation from across conferences. You are going to get to, you know, again, you're going to have to get even more people. In the past, this has largely been northern schools pushing for this kind of thing for competitive balance. But now this pandemic has made it less about competitive balance and more about the overall survival of the sports due to finances. And this would be a huge savings for a lot of schools around the country. All right, we are behind for a break. We're going to take our timeout. When we come back, we will get into the last dance a little bit, what we have time to get into. That's when we return. Leprechaun Lunch, presented by Bud Light Seltzer, 96.1 WSBT, the sports leader. Leprechaun Lunch with Sean and Sharpley, 96.1 WSBT, the sports leader. We're presented by Bud Light Seltzer in four refreshing fruit flavors with former Notre Dame quarterback and baseball player Evan Sharpley. I'm Sean Stiers. Just a few minutes left to go in the show. The Last Dance, of course, the Michael Jordan Chicago Bulls documentary wrapped up last weekend. The 10-episode run ended up being the most watched documentary ever, averaged more than 5.6 million viewers per episode. Evan, let's get into the Scottie Pippen stuff since we have just a few minutes here. His image kind of took a hit throughout most of this series, and Horace Grant, who was part of that 91-93 first three-peat run, former teammate of Pippen and of Michael Jordan, not real happy with either how Pippen or himself were portrayed in that. The last episode really kind of showed him playing through the back injury in the 98 finals, showed Scottie Pippen there. He kind of needed that rebound, it seemed like, don't you think, after the way he was portrayed for a good deal?
Well, between, you know, his contract dispute going on and kind of sitting
the
out.
The foot injury.
The foot injury where he could have had surgery and you know, Jordan calling him selfish during that. You know, I think that Horace Grant definitely has a point that, you know, I think Jordan was maybe a little hard on how he, you know, attacked in those situations. I think that's his personality, though. But there's no denying, you know, Scottie Pippen's value to the Bulls. You know, there's no denying what he meant to that team and how good of a number two he was to Jordan. And even when Jordan was retired and playing baseball, you know, what Scottie Pippen did with that team and Grant spoke on that too. So, you know, it was the fallout from this is kind of funny. You know, Horace Grant now calling Michael Jordan a snitch for, right. You know, possibly, you know, especially too his comments about cocaine and women in the locker room. You know, that stuff that's supposed to be deemed kind of off limits is talking about that. And that's why originally Michael Jordan.
Names, I guess.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. He didn't. But, you know, that's why Jordan originally went after Grant was the book that was written where there was somebody saying something and it only seemed that it could have been someone within the locker room. And Grant said, well, you know, once MJ kind of has it out for you, you're kind of written off, which right. is not false. And Jordan would probably agree with it.
Well, you know what struck me about this whole thing, though, because there were some people who didn't want to sit down, you know, for the camera and talk about this stuff. But Horace Grant was obviously more than willing to sit down and talk about it. And at least in what they ended up including in the show, he wasn't dishing dirt. But really, over the 5-week run of this thing, 10 episodes, 5 weeks, ESPN itself never really got into the negative stuff. I mean, you know, there was the controversy with Isaiah Thomas and stuff like that. But it really took until... And Scottie Pippen never talked to the media, you know, even though he talked for the doc, he didn't talk to the media during this. But it really took until the entire series was over for more of this, you know, ultimate controversy to kind of blow up a little bit this week.
Yeah, and the guy probably coming out of this looking the worst, though, is Jerry Krause.
Well, yeah.
And the thing is, too, though, is I wish he would still get credit for assembling the team he did, you know, and he had a methodology that he believed in, which was why ultimately, you know, Phil Jackson ended up being let go, not retained, and then kind of the fizzle out effect of that. Now, he certainly looks bad because if they would have came back the following year, you got to think they would have still been in contention, even though some of these guys were getting older in age, right, as far as the number of minutes that Krause would have on a player's body. But I don't think he does get enough credit for, I mean, they won six championships. Well, so he obviously did something right, but you know how it ended, you're always wondering what if.
Right. And I think that at some point during that he got his share of credit. It does seem like maybe he wanted even more credit than maybe was deserved. I mean, I do definitely give him full credit. I mean, he drafted everyone in that signed everyone in that late run with the exception of Jordan. Jordan was drafted before Krause got the job. I do kind of wish they would have, you know, at least maybe given his family, you know, some airtime in this.
Yeah, but overall, great documentary. You know, it was fun to watch. And I know there's a couple more on tap now, Lance Armstrong and Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa. So anything with steroids, you can count me in for.
Yeah, that's right. And they've been teasing the Armstrong. It's more interesting than I thought, so I'll be tuned into that, I'm sure.
Sign me up. I'm ready.
That's right. For Evan Sharpley, for studio engineer Jess Hollis, I'm Sean Steyer's Leprechaun Lunch with Sean and Sharpley, presented by Bud Light Seltzer, 100 calories, 2 grams of carbs, Bud Light Seltzer, WSBT South Bend.